This evening, we are very privileged to welcome Professor Danny Dorley from Oxford University. He is the Alfred Mackinder Professor of Geography, and Alfred Mackinder goes back even farther than John Eld. And Alfred Mackinder is one of the pioneers of British geography, and hence, geographers, as you can see, like to pay memory to people who served the subject in the past. And tonight, we're very grateful to Danny for coming to us here in Stoke-on-Trent, one of those forgotten cities almost, and we're going to hear about what Brexit tells us about the British. Danny Dorley. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming. You may not feel so privileged by the end of this, depending on how it goes. This is only the third time I've tried to do this talk. The reason for the picture of the book is this book is published on the 15th of January, by which I should have done this talk 50 times, and then I'll be doing it another 100 times probably afterwards. So I need to get it right. I need you to tell me what I'm getting wrong. It's not an easy subject to talk about. It might become an even harder subject to talk about as we go forward. But it is fascinating. It is, and of course it's geography. I mean, not enough people have said this is all about geography. It's all about borders. We've learnt an enormous amount about geography and about borders that we didn't know, most of us, a couple of years ago. And the vote has told us, I think, a lot about ourselves, but it also tells us a lot about the people who analyse the votes, including me. So the question for you tonight is how much of what you're going to get is about what really happened, and how much of it is Danny's thoughts about the world, which may or may not be that useful to you. And Brexit is particularly interesting for this. When Brexit, the referendum is a vote. And traditionally with votes, they're for general elections, those are the ones you mainly study. We know what to do. You get the data, you run a model, you write a paper. The paper is very much like the paper you wrote 5 years earlier. So it looks like you know what you're doing. And you say the same kinds of things that people said 5 years ago, but with a little twist, and you appear to be authoritative, and you appear to be knowledgeable, and you appear to be neutral. Now, as I'm going to show you, the Brexit referendum and what's happened after Brexit is unlike anything we've ever seen before. The geography of the vote is unlike anything we've seen before. And I think I can say this with some confidence because I have drawn more maps of more things in Britain to do with human geography than anybody else. And I was getting very bored drawing these maps because you draw a map of GCSE results, it looks like a map of health, it looks like a map of house prices. They all, maps all look the same. And then we get this map and it looked different. I'm going to show you the maps, I'm going to show you far too many graphs in a minute. I'm also going to split this talk to have questions, I think, twice throughout it, because I'm worried about going off piece and what you're thinking. And this is, I'll give you my last little worry before you get the slides, there are a lot of them. The only job I've ever had outside of working in universities is being a play worker looking after children in the 1980s when we used to have play workers. And one of the things I got most terribly wrong was some teenagers playing a game around a fire. And the game goes like this. You pick one teenager at random, and you tell that teenager that there's going to be a story. And they have to go away from the fire, and the others are going to concoct the story. And then you come back, and you can only ask people questions to which they can only answer yes or no. And you've got to work out what the story is. Never let teenagers do this. Because I don't know if you know the trick, but the trick is there is no story. The poor 15, 16-year-old boy goes off and comes back and begins to ask, does it involve a haunted house? Yes, no. And what you actually get is a look into the inner thinking of the 15, 16-year-old child. And it's cruel. don't know. Similarly, analysing Brexit, if you look at the academics who've written about what the vote means, who've studied it, who've run the regression models on it, the results that they give and the stories that they give vary so much that they're actually telling you about themselves. If they believe this is the rising of the working class who were otherwise going to UKIP or from Labour, that's the story they will tell you. If they believe that sovereignty is incredibly important, they will tell you the British people rose up for sovereignty. And you're going to hear my version of this tonight. And this is new territory, this situation we're in where we can't pretend to be knowledgeable, doing the normal tricks that we do that confuse people by reciting things that were known before. We're into new territory. Let me give you a little bit of background. A lot of Brexit is about immigration. If you look at election surveys, general election surveys, going way back before 1997, when people are asked what is the most important issue, at almost every election, apart from 2010, they said it was immigration. We didn't like writing about that, so we didn't put that in our papers, but immigration came above the NHS, it became above the economy, apart from 2010. Only the biggest economic crash since 1929 wiped immigration, well, to second place as the most salient issue in the minds of British voters. And that's obviously a big thing about Brexit. How many of you were born in Stoke? Right? What about third? How many born in Staffordshire? How many born outside of those two areas? The migrants. How many of you are born overseas? Interesting. Get very different. If I do that in my home city of Oxford, I never get anybody born in Oxford. Hardly ever in Oxfordshire. And I will get at least a third born overseas in most talks I do in the town and the university. And the really interesting thing, of course, is places like Oxford that are absolutely full of migrants. And it's places like here that have far fewer. That's one of the highest rates of people saying they're actually a local. Depends on your age, if you're young enough. You've had long enough to look at the graph. I've left the graph up because I'm very proud of the graph. I didn't actually draw it. My friend Beth drew it. Nobody else has drawn this graph. It's the graph of where people living in Britain at each census from 1841 were born if they're born overseas. And it kind of shows you a whole huge range of countries towards the end. But the interesting thing about the British, that's us, is that we're not interested in that. We haven't bothered to draw that. The Americans draw this kind of graph in America, but we don't. All we do when we look at that is say, oh look, quite a lot of people at the end. 7-8 million people going up, that control. What's going to happen next? If you were to add to that graph everybody born in Britain but with one parent born overseas, you get another set of lines. If you then did it for people with one grandparent, you get another, and very quickly you'd have a majority of the population. But we don't do that. Same graph, different scale, different message. But you might still say, when you look at that, going, oh, that's a bit of a shock. That's a bit sudden. That's a lot of people. It's not unusual. I'll show you why it's not unusual in a minute. It's essentially not unusual because people are moving around more. Let's play the sibling game. How many of you have got a sibling who doesn't live in England? Yes, they're all mine. How many of you have got a cousin or a parent who doesn't live in England? How many of you got a parent who lives in Wales? We're all within a couple. Only one, so it's not from here. Biggest immigrant group in the UK are the English in Wales. Most socially destructive. They buy the nicer houses because they've got more money. They don't learn the language. They look down on the locals. anyway. I've asked you questions not too long, and the question about whether I'm being patronised is, we can have an argument about what it feels like when people arrive where you live, and whether it disrupts things and is terrible. I now live where I grew up. Almost nobody I've worked with lives there anymore. I can tell you a feeling of what it's like. But it isn't the end of the world. Here's a couple of more complicated maps. These are cartograms. This is north of England. It's from an atlas better than I did, published around about 2016. It is showing you the most common and second most common ethnic identity of people aged 16 to 24. Who's aged 16 to 24? Okay, keep your hand up if you're white British. Yes, that's most of you. Okay, all those blues are areas where the most common is white British, and then the second most common is other white. But the other colours that we've got, the kind of pinks, it's white British, and then something else. That's the kind of country we live in. It's a white British country, with occasional areas, more in the north, where the largest minority is not another kind of white. This is the south. Even more blue, even more constituencies, but basically, and this is youngsters, who are more ethnically diverse, even more constituencies which are either white or other white. I've highlighted Stoke, three constituencies there, where the colours are white, British, Indian, apparently, for most of the three constituencies of Stoke. And the little yellow one is half a constituency, white, British, mixed white, black, Caribbean. So there you go, youngsters in Stoke, those are kind of the groups. Now, that's where we are. Is it unusual? Depends on your age, depends what you're used to. Depends when you've grown up. Depends on your family. Or not. Is it unusual in Europe? Here's the map of Europe, the latest data from 2014, a couple of years before the vote. Again, we've stretched the map. The map's stretched and areas into the population. Down here, this is Spain. You're looking at Madrid. You're looking at Barcelona. And you're looking at a hell of a lot of immigrants. The dark blue means that over a fifth of the population were born outside the country of the region being shown. This is Spain and this is the coast, so who are the immigrants?
South Africa.
Not North Africans.
British.
The biggest group. Lesson. Let's hope they don't come back. Because they're not that young. Anyway, that's an example of what a large influx of immigrants looks like. That coast of Spain. Or that country in the middle of Switzerland. Now it's partly high in Switzerland, because Switzerland has this kind of really weird shape. There's some mountains in the middle. And everybody who lives in Switzerland is rather near to a border, so it's not that hard to get across, even though Switzerland's not in the EU. But still, you know, Switzerland's quite high. And then all those other blue dots are the middle of the cities, and there's Paris. And so you've hopefully been looking at the UK now. And in the UK, apart from Ireland, where there are obvious reasons why people may be born in a different country, given that Northern Ireland is a different country to the Republic, apart from Ireland, it is just half of the west side of inner London. That's it for 20% plus born abroad. And the north of England, all the way from here northwards, is that yellow colour, which is less than 5%, often less than 2%, hardly any migrants. As many as in Eastern Europe. That's, now you may think, oh, they're hiding. We can talk about that. But that is the map. So whatever happened, it didn't happen because we have many more migrants than other places. And of course we know that almost, but not quite, the best candidate for the vote, because the fewer migrants you had, the more likely you were to vote Leave, and actually to say it's migrants. Not the best candidate. We'll get the best candidate a bit later. But it wasn't the migration. So the question is, what was it? What was going on in this country to be the first country since Greenland to leave the European community? Greenland left a long time ago. Greenland had 56,000 people. It's a lot of people. They spent 3 years working out a deal without leaving, just to get it right. And Greenland has fish, which helps. And we'll get on to that later. But also Greenland, although they left the EU, they kept Danish citizenship, which gave them European citizenship. Now we could try to date that nobody's mentioned the Greenland deal yet, you know, in Brussels. You know, forget Canada, forget Chequers, forget, you know, could we have the Greenland deal with us? You know, where we don't lose out anything. Anyway, that's your map of immigration. What about people's views? What about people's views on the Remain or Leave performance? I'll come clean with my view early on. Okay, so I'm obviously somebody who voted and supported Remain. However, in hindsight, I think if it had been anything less than 66% Remain, we would be in a kind of continuous quagmire. We'll be talking about the second or third referendum. Everything that was going wrong in Britain would be blamed on the fact that we haven't left, and that the establishment had stitched up the vote because the BBC and the Church and the University of Oxford and all three political parties and everybody in the city and the trade unions were all on one side. And it would have gone on and on and on for the rest of my life until I died. In hindsight, 48-52, in hindsight for me, is almost perfect because it brings it all to a head. It's like lancing a boil. We're going to find out if our problems are all caused by immigration. We're going to find out pretty bloody quickly. Hopefully we can be decent or civilised enough that the way in which we find this out isn't too awful, and hopefully we still know how to queue. And that may be something that isn't a joke by the time I'm doing this talk in the 29th of March. But in hindsight, and you may disagree with me, I think this would have gone on and on. And it may not go on and on now, because it's bringing a lot of things to the surface that we weren't aware of or we heard or we didn't like to talk about. Just as I used to go to these election conferences every year, and somebody put up a table, the table saying most salient issues and most voters immigration, and go, well, stop talking about that, let's talk about something else that you want to talk about. You'd be looking at some text about people's opinions about Remain and Leave. Here is a graph. The graph begins shortly after the financial crash. The financial crash is probably fairly important, but remember, the financial crash happened to everyone else in Europe and initially had the worst effect on Greece, but Greece hasn't left and isn't leaving. Very high proportions wanting to leave to 11 to 12. David Cameron, whose most interesting quote is to say, I'm just lucky. David Cameron believed he was having inherent luck. David Cameron calls the referendum at a point when he thinks he can win it, when Remain is in the majority. Remain in the majority all the way through, so fairly near to the vote. Sims up and down a bit, there's a little bit of panic. George Osborne comes out saying you'll be £4,000 or £5,000 worse off a year. Boris comes out saying the NHS will get however many millions. Next year, 350. If we wanted the health system of Germany, by the way, you'd have to write 1,050,000,000 on the bus every week. anyway. There he goes, bouncing around. An MP is stabbed to death by a man shouting out about Britain. The spread betting says there's no way this thing's going to go otherwise. The spread betting doesn't get it wrong. And we're all sitting comfortably there on the night, going, this will be a bit interesting, but I can't be bothered to stay up. Because it's so obvious what's going to happen. Because you all know what's going to happen. Because you know so much about elections, because we've studied elections, we've modelled elections, and we're so expert. And of course people are not going to be stupid enough to do this, are they? Because we haven't even thought about what would happen if they did. In hindsight, this is utterly incredible. There was some even more incredible news released on the day after. Understandably, you've never heard of the second news story on the day after Brexit. In fact, I'm not even sure any newspaper covered the second most important news story. 23rd of June 2016, the Office of National Statistics released the mid-year estimates as scheduled on the mid-year date that they always release it on, and announced that an extra 50,000 people had suddenly died in the preceding months in a way that had never happened in peacetime before. Nobody noticed, because we're all shocked by Brexit. If you're trying to work out what's happening to Britain, that is an important thing. It's got worse since. The BBC News, second or third headline yesterday, life expectancy falling in real terms for the first time since they measured it in a particular way, since 1982. But it's actually the first time life expectancy has fallen since the Second World War. And in fact, only the year in the Second World War when the most injured men came back from Dunkirk and the bombing was worse. Quite staggering. But that story, what should be the biggest story in the news now, infant mortality has risen for 2 years in a row. A baby is less likely to survive their first 4 weeks of life now than they were last year. They were less likely last year than the year before. It's actually getting harder for a baby to survive in this country. That's in terms of you to send people back. All of that is wiped out by Brexit. Nothing like this has happened in the last 30 or 40 years. The nearest we have to it is suits. And that's tiny compared to this. So was it the settled will of the British people? I warned you of graphs. Even worse, I'm going to show you a graph that nobody's tried to draw these kind of graphs before, which is probably a terribly stupid thing to try to do. We'll pause in about 5 minutes for some questions. Along the y-axis going up, you've got the level of support in the polls, and the average of polls every month for far right parties. Referendum Party, National Front, British National Party, UKIP. I put them all in this far right. If you're feeling upset about that, because you're UKIP, don't worry. Later on, we're going to put an even bigger party in the far right. Can anybody remember Mr. Gonsby from 1997? Mm-hmm. Getting, was it a video he sent to every household? The referendum party. Anyway, 1 or 2%. That's the first belt. This thing spirals around. You see it's going round and around. The x-axis is how fast it's going up and down. The y-axis is the level it's getting to. And it's a series of spirals that goes up. That isn't a rising tide of opinion. That is something being whipped up for particular dates, and the minute after that date passes, bam, it goes away again. And people no longer care. And the dates are 2004, 2009, 2014, and it's European elections, and it's the tabloids supporting UKIP and the far right, up and up and up again. Currently it's down at 1%. UKIP has gone all the way down to the very bottom. If we get a people's vote, I bet you, they will zoom it up 25%. Absolutely bet that's what will happen. But we may probably not get to know. On this side, different set of figures. And again, in hindsight, and we never saw this. I didn't see this. Nobody, as far as I know, saw this. It's kind of better than a financial crash. You know anything about a financial crash. There's a quite a lot of academics came out after and went, I wrote a book about that, you know. The banks know that it was going to happen. And the trick is just basically write a book every 10 years saying the banks are no good, they're going to crash. Anyway, The nice thing about Brexit, at least, is that nobody did write a book beforehand about how this is going to happen. But if they had written a book, this set of numbers would have been in it. This is the proportion of the electorate that each European election we have ever had, because the first one was 1979, the proportion of the electorate voting for a party to the right of normal European Conservatives. 79, no candidates, none. Despite the fact, I mean, I remember 79 in the National Front, it wasn't much fun. 84, no. 89, National Front, there were a few candidates, and one in 1,000 people votes for the National Front. 94, 1.1, 1999, getting a bit of UKIP, 7.5, 2004, 20.4 UKIP and all the other far-right parties. Now, I played the trick in 2009 of adding half the Tory vote. Why have I done that? The reason I've done that is in 2009, the Conservatives left the normal European bloc of MEPs. They hadn't yet entered the new bloc. By 2014, 2 years before the Brexit vote, the Conservative and Unionist Party of Great Britain was aligned with the far right of Europe, with Alternative for Deutschland, with the Free Finns, with the people in Sweden that we're screaming about now. Our Conservative Party had become a European far-right party. In a very simple definition, they were to the right of the big European Conservative group. And once you end up in 2014, the Conservative, the UKIP, the BNP, the English Democrats, and all the others, and there's a lot of them, you find that over half the population of Britain voted for something to the right of normal European Conservatives, 2 years before Brexit. And we talk about Orban and Hungary. We did it, and we didn't even know we were doing it, because to us it's normal, because this is normal. I'm going to zip through quickly a few other things. Here's the map that is absolutely amazing. No other map looks like it. We're going to learn more about it in a minute. Scotland has a different enemy. London very concentrated, but most of the map is blue. That's the key thing, most of the map. You've been told it's Sunderland and Stoke and Great Yarmouth and Redcar and Merthyr. And that's not true. This is the other fascinating thing. The graph at the bottom there is the pound going down over time. When my granddad was a boy, you could get $5 to the pound. When my mum was a girl, you could get four. When I was a boy, you could get $3. I could actually get 10 francs to the pound when my school took me to France when I was 15. 10 francs. If you were in Gatwick last week, you'd pay £1.11 for a euro. The reason to show you that graph is that something big has happened over time to this country, over a long amount of time. This graph is by age, including not voting. And once you include people not voting, and not voting numbers are not certain. Right? It's very hard to be sure about not voting numbers. But once you include not voting, then the group who voted most solidly remained were 35 to 44 year olds. Not the youngest, because the youngest, well, they probably weren't in bed, but they didn't vote. Why didn't the youngest vote? Because way back in 1991, we taxed them for voting, it's called the poll tax, and suddenly they stopped voting in 1992. The youngest has started voting again in Britain in June 2017, the first time since 1992. Young adults have started voting again. But the most interesting thing is the rise by age. Now, this is not elderly people voting selfishly for themselves. They know they're not going to be around that long at the end of it. This is elderly people voting for what they think is best for their grandchildren in future, when you look at what people ask. And it's elderly people who have lived through this. Let's have a look at the geography. Three more slides and then I'm going to ask you to ask me. Don't bother about a graph. I'll show you another graph in a minute better. This is a story they didn't tell you, that they could have told you on the night or the day of the vote if they had had the imagination. after this was published in the British Medical Journal, it's a funny bit, more people voted Leave in Essex than in the combined districts of Allerdale, Barrow, Blackburn, Blaenau Gwent, Carlisle, Cleveland, Craven, Copeland, Highburn, Rosie, Lancaster, Lincoln, Pendle, Redcar, Ribble Valley, Lichfieldshire, Rochdale, Rossendale, Rutland, Rydale, Selby and Scarborough, all put together. And it's not because Essex has got a bigger population, Essex has actually got less people than all those areas put together. Essex has a smaller electorate than all those people put together. What happened is Essex turned out the vote. The turnout was like, and they voted Leave. And that's Essex. Much more important than all those northern towns combined. Here's the last graph on this. It's the dark areas are more than 53% voting Leave. It's by constituency for England. The least deprived area, Penn, votes Remain. Rich Britain voted Remain. The strongest Leave for deciles 4, 5, 6. Middle England. Middle England voted out, not the poorest areas. Hampshire. County of Hampshire. The county of Hampshire contains fewer people and a smaller electorate than Derby, Blackpool, Rotherham, Sheffield, which is huge. Sheffield's the fifth largest city in England. Sheffield, Great Yarmouth, Hartlepool and Merthyr. But more people voted out in Hampshire than all of those put together. Nobody has come to say it was Hampshire that did it. One last one. More people voted leaving Kent than the combined populations of Bolsover, Doncaster, Hull, Chesterfield, Salford, Stoke-on-Trent and Salford. Now, I am sad enough, but I'm actually going to go through the rest of the home counties in the next few weeks. I'm going to go through Berkshire, Oxfordshire, Buckinghamshire. And I'm just going to show it was the home counties that did it. And the question is, why don't we tell that story? It's a really municipal story. It is, if you're an academic, if you live in Remain Central, which is Oxford, Cambridge, London, it's where your parents live, and your vote. And we just didn't like that story. We knew when we went home at Christmas that they voted Leave, but we wanted to blame somebody else. Let's have a go. I must have annoyed somebody by now. So we have a couple of questions and then I'll carry on.
Yeah, I'll just ask a question.
Go on.
And one of the things that horrified me is the way that the Daily Mail has headlines about immigration, one after the other, weeks and weeks and weeks on end.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether anybody's ever done a study on the circulation of the Daily Mail. And I knew that anti-Brexit tabloids is linked to the point.
The map. I don't. They may have done. Because they include readership with the surveys of voting. And Understanding Society, which has surveyed 40,000 people, has had a series of academic studies. So we've loved they've done. The problem is that you can correlate a lot of things about them. Somebody's produced a fake mad cow disease map. That really, not the real one. It is just the Brexit voting versus and did that. But that would be very interesting. What has been done is the Media Monitoring Centre at Glasgow have looked at every paragraph of the newspapers every day in the year up and just watched them ratchet it up. You'd almost be mad not to vote Leave if you read these papers. Because they were telling you the awful things that were happening in this country. One more question? Thank you, Matt.
Yeah, I was just wondering, because you're looking at numbers, but traditionally has what I understand to be low turnout in elections. Does that impact the numbers versus the home counties, if you see what I mean?
Okay.
Is it that less people from Stoke voted in the election in general?
Yes. Yes, it's turnout's key.
Okay.
So the point is Stoke didn't get us to Leave, the people didn't vote in Stoke. Right? It's high turnout plus high Leave is what happened in the home counties. And it's there, it's not that political journalists are unable to see this. I think it's that they don't want to. Well, maybe I want to. You know, maybe it's just I've got people that hate it, of the counties that I come from, I'm a home county boy. The Home Council Code, if anybody can find me the first initial definition, I'll be very grateful. There's loads of definitions suggesting they're waiting to go home from London on particular kind of tube lines. But that doesn't make sense, because most of them are way away from here, the tube line, and they've never called Home Councils before those lines went there. I think, and I'd love it to be true, I think they're the Home Counties because they're where you came home to from Empire. When you've done your 20 years in India, the cottage with the roses around the door, even if you grew up in Barrow, your idea was you can go back to Barrow, so it's a family.
But if you're Scottish, you can walk along
the Scottish and the Romans, I don't know. Oh, yeah. Scotland was very significant. Yeah, and you wouldn't go back to the Home Counties of England, you go to the Home Counties of Scotland. I'll do one more, then I'll carry on.
Starts by saying the correlation wasn't X, Y, and Z, immigration, whatever. He's saying it's purely geographic.
No, I'm changing the correlation. I'm saving the correlation.
Okay.
Let me guess. If you look at me, it gives you a clue towards what the smallest correlation is. Don't really want to look at me, but. Okay. Going to have to zoom on because we must not be here all night, but you can see this thing. But it's fascinating. If you're a social scientist, then you probably haven't lived here. Right. We're not normal. We're not normal. There are lots of ways in which it's possible to show we're not normal. The easiest way is just ask somebody from the mainland, definitely after a couple of drinks, to tell you about ourselves. We are the Americans of Europe. We're the Texans, if you like. We don't think we're not normal, we think we're normal. This is the Gini coefficient of inequality, used by OECD. There's a story I read this morning about 30,000 people being murdered in one part of Mexico at the moment. Anybody else listen to radio for? Mexico's in a very bad way. The Gini coefficient of 0.5 would occur if we split it in half, and you lot, we're going to give you a household income of 75,000 a year. And you lot are going to get 25,000 a year for your family to live on. 75,000, 25, you've got a cleaner, you're a cleaner, you get two holidays, you get no holiday. That's 0.5. Mexico's not quite 0.5. Then Chile, Turkey, United States, which is a country with lots of problems, we're beginning to work out. We're going to spend all the ground rent to every summer to get ideas for things like magnet schools and gifted and talented. Lithuania, then Russia. Russia's a country with lots of problems. We skip us and then Israel. Israel, including Gaza and West Bank, is slightly economically more equal by income than we are. And just to save time, I'm not going to show you the 30 other normal countries of the OECD. The ones in which people do better at school, live for longer, the houses are cheaper than our quality. We're weird. How did we get weird? We started off with, everyone was weird 100 years ago. The top line is how much the top 10% have. It's about half 100 years ago. Upstairs, downstairs, servants, country houses. But this is the same world over. Zooms down, everywhere becomes more equal. By the time I was the age of these students who were beginning to try to stay awake on the front line, this country was the second most equal large European country to Sweden. Incredible change. That's the reason I grew up here. Second most economically equal country. And I've been wax lyrical about what that meant, about why we went camping, and why you didn't worry about what school you went to. Because you just got rid of the grammars. It's great. Nobody knew what the good or bad school was. Now they do. But then we zoom up there. And then what he's doing, I won't show you the message, but everybody else did that. No, they didn't. They didn't. The Netherlands didn't. Switzerland didn't. The top 1% have paid half as much in Switzerland as here. We did that. Nowhere else in Europe did that. What goes wrong? Just one of these. This is the measure of inequality along the bottom. This is how good people are at maths. Not at your range. If I give you a maths question now, you'll do fairly well because you have got. Well, that's through the audience. Okay, this is tricky because of Let It Go. Who got a 9, new language? 9, We've got an 8, 9, well done, I'm a 7. We've got an 8, we've got a 7, we've got a 6. Right, who got an A? A star. Who got an A? Who got a B? Who got a C? For the older members of the audience, who got a 1? Old members. Anyway, forget about it. By the time you're 24, you can't do it anymore. Because, well, especially the youngsters, because we teach maths to get the maximum maths grade on the day of the test. Because grades matter. You don't teach to actually learn, understand, or imagine this, like maths. The Americans are worse, but essentially we're useless at maths tests. Same for problem solving, same for literacy. Why are we so unusual? It's kind of not our fault. Well, somewhere was going to be the centre of the biggest empire the world would ever know. Let's put it like that. If it hadn't been us, it would have been somewhere else, probably here. Scotland and England had a magic convenience. They had a magic convenience to the point we worked out that the Spanish were bringing an awful lot of gold across and we could pirate it slightly less illegally. And the empire rose and the empire fell. And we've never told ourselves the real story of it. We told ourselves it was a white man's burden. We told ourselves it civilized the world. We told ourselves we took democracy everywhere. We told ourselves that we invented the steam train and the spinning jetty and every other thing you can invent. And people were lucky to have that. We told ourselves almost that we invented China. So it was a giveaway. Giveaway in name. And then what we made was bought all across the empire because it was the highest quality and it was the very best. We told ourselves that. We don't ship China halfway around the world, whether it's the very best or not, unless somebody forces you to, because it breaks. I lived for a few months in New Zealand, and above the shelf of the supermarket in New Zealand, where here it will say linen, it still says Manchester. The word Manchester is what they still use in New Zealand. And why was the linen made in Manchester? Because we stopped the Indian textile industry being automated. If you go on and on about this. We're still working out this. The daughter of my chancellor of my university, why was she crying?
Hong Kong.
She was crying because the last colony was going and we're losing Hong Kong. She cried for 4 hours. Why was she crying? She's told the newspaper why she's crying.
Leaving Hong Kong.
No? Have you got a job? No? Come on, she's a young woman.
What's the
home? Not home.
Boyfriend,
the surfer. She was crying because she just happened to leave the boyfriend. It was all terribly unfair. But we portrayed it, you know, as if this was some kind of emblematic empire moment of patriotic grief. Right? It's on the public domain. He was a very nice surfer boy. He wanted to stay as a surfer boy. She was told she had to go to this awful cold, wet country where they lose the max. I won't go through Border Force. One of the times I felt most ashamed was watching our Border Force on the dockside in Lesbos. Because those people in rubber dinghies coming over from Turkey, you know, they were a real threat, aren't they? There's the empire. That's the largest extent of the empire as far as we've been able to work it out. Shaped by population now. One reason to show you that is to ask the question, if you were choosing your next head of that now what is likely a commonwealth, and you thought it mattered, wouldn't you choose somebody from India? I won't say any more than that, but just to say, if you think the commonwealth is terribly important, why didn't they choose somebody from India to be the next head? Suez Canal, it was moving goods that we made other people largely buy, and it was moving goods that we wanted to us. When I studied geography at school, I was told where to get rubber and tin from. Resource geography, because we should have it. What do we make? It's all they are, isn't it? All they are in advanced manufacturing and pharmaceuticals and biotechnology, because we're such a brilliant country. This is what we make cars. Sometimes we make cars with robots. 1% of our manufacturing output is made in my city of Oxford by robots, by BMW. But that is what we make. And the problem with that is that other people can make that. It's not like fish in Greenland. It's not a particular special advantage. You could say, well, we have an enormous banking sector, and we could argue about just how attractive that banking sector is to other people. Smoke Empire Tobacco. You want to smoke tobacco and make sure it's Empire. Couple of graphs of trade. Of course, we trade mostly with European countries, and of course, they trade mostly with us. Our exports are actually slipping by about $1 billion a year. We're not doing particularly well. Here is India. It's at the bottom. We don't make things that India needs. We certainly don't make them at a price that India is going to buy. But I don't have to tell you this by the 29th of March. It's beginning to become obvious. When I became a young geography lecturer in Bristol in 1996, a man called Peter Haggett said, I must meet the new young MP, Liam Fox. He's full of bright ideas. And Liam's coming, going around the world, working out these trade deals. This is, I shouldn't do it like this, you can tell me not to. I don't know, but I know you should try to make talks a bit funny. But it isn't funny, is it? So I'm not quite sure how to do it. I really do think that what is happening is we're coming to terms with why we were different. We're coming to terms with the fact that it wasn't the trade unions in the 1970s that made us poorer, because everybody had trade unions. It was losing the last colonies. We got a tribute income. We joined the European community in an attempt to stop getting poorer because we hadn't yet coped with the fact we didn't understand why we were getting poorer. We haven't had to make something that we haven't been able to force somebody else to buy for 200 years. We think we should naturally be great. We can't understand why we're going down. And we don't even teach our own history to ourselves. Every school children in China is told that the reason that China collapsed economically was the British sent gunboats and forced them to buy the opium that they were growing in India. That's the opium wars. And we flooded China with our opium. We don't have that in the GCSE. It's just all that. What we have in the GCSE is that in 1066 the English were patriotic and happy best. And you've got to write that if you want to get your 6-mark question on the A through A board. Quite how they surveyed the English in 1066 to check they were patriotic Afghans, I don't know. But we're still teaching children that. Just one more slide with another couple of questions. Here's the manufacturing output. I haven't extended the axis all the way to zero because every country has some manufacturing. But if we think we're going to be selling things, we're not. What we can sell is tourism. Power dropping means that we can get more people here. And we've got all the architecture of empire to show. In my university, we like to pretend it's medieval. It's not. Even some of the oldest buildings, you can look at each building and you can work out which plantation of Barbados was used to get the money for the man who donated the money to start the actual building. We're an empire university. Tourism thing. We could get more tourism. Education is something else we could sell if we don't manage to muck it up so that it has a reputation for being corrupt. We can get more overseas students. But if we think that we're suddenly going to do a James Dyson, and that is only a vacuum cleaner, and it's only 20 odd jobs in Mars because they're moving out to China, we're not. And not in a hurry. My favourite country in Europe is Finland. If you want to model of a country, If you want the only country in Europe to have homelessness falling because they've worked out a way to deal with it, if you want the highest school results, if you want the country in Europe with the highest increase in life expectancy in the last 6 years, it's Finland. And that little knock at the end of Finland, that's Nokia going almost bust because of the Apple phone. But imagine turning it around. But you know, Finland's a really big, strong country. Just a bit more sensible. Let's stop there before the last part. I'll do another couple of questions before I work out going to TV studio with, and then I'll end with the last
two.
Two
questions that are kind of related. The first one, when you mentioned that, I think you said 1997, immigration was the top voting issue, bar the 2010 vote. How far back does it go? So does it go far back before 1992, does it go back before 73, or when does that start to become the top? And then also, there's been a lot of discussion this week at the Labour Party conference about if they go for people's votes, that somehow they're going to give up the working class vote that voted to leave, but there's going to be an upside for all these new.
But
you're saying suggests that's not true, that they're actually going to lose the middle class, the Labour votes that they try to get in the Labour.
Yeah, the majority, 51% of their Leave vote was ABC One. Only 24% was single D. It's majority middle class vote.
But do those percentages in terms of their consistency boundaries and things? I mean, whatever your stats tell you about the character of the social class.
Oh, no, no. These are different facts. But these are from, bless him, Lord Ashcroft, who owns the publisher who published his book, like that. Lord Ashcroft commissioned the largest exit poll ever for this. We've got some wonderful data, only if people who voted, because you haven't voted to make the poll. Lord Ashcroft, I think, commissioned it because he thought Leave was going to lose and wanted all the evidence of who'd been what. And so we know in enormous detail who voted. And it is ABC One as majority, and the majority of votes to leave in the south of England. Because the turnout was high. Yeah. I mean, of course there are working class people who are pissed off and voted leave because they're annoyed, not just because of immigration. How else do you tell the powers that be that you're annoyed? You know, in the way that our voting works in Britain, in most constituencies, it doesn't matter how many votes, it's not going to change anything. We give people, for the first time in their lives, a vote that might actually matter. And we give them two choices. Carry on as normal, or something else, and that's part of what went on. I'm oversimplifying it, the same. The coverage of Labour Party conference, I think, has been interesting. I bet you, 2 weeks from now, it'll all be forgotten, because so much will have happened in the next 14 days. And politicians are beginning to get wise to this, but the speed of events is so fast that a vague commitment to possibly support the people's vote or whatever, won't be there. Okay, last bit. So he's not going home. Here's the map again in black and white. If you're fascinated by it, it's a very high remain vote in certain areas. But a Leave majority in most of the rest of the country. Basically, it's where the winners are. The winners voted remain. Life's doing well for you in London. If life goes badly in London, if you get sick, if you lose your job, and you split up, you have to leave. There's a wonderful historical stay. You can see the migration of divorcees across Britain and out. The Cotswolds is halfway. Highest proportion of stepchildren is in the Cotswolds. The area with the highest number of divorced people is Blackpool. Divorce centre. And it's this caravan. There are key individuals involved in the Leave vote that we haven't taken very seriously. There's a lot of money. More money was spent on Leave than the Main. The money is predominantly from old white men, some of it's hidden, who have a particular love of empire and colonies. A disproportionate number of them actually grew up in the colony. A disproportionate number of the people who funded Leave had a black nanny as a child. Now, I'm a geographer, not a psychologist, but this thing is fascinating. Matthew didn't. Matthew went to Leeds Boys, minor private school. Matthew was the chief executive of both Leeds. Matthew, when we asked him if he could use his picture, said, oh yes, of course you can use my picture. It's that's in the book. He, Nicotia, he. And then there's our friend Hobbes. We took out from the book any mention of his offspring, which is not the animal. I've used Hobbes to illustrate the highest correlation with Lee. The strongest correlation with Lee, published just a few weeks after the vote, is with Public Health England's estimate of levels of obesity. Now, the somewhat naive researcher from the University, I think of East Anglia, who published this, was pilloried in the Sun and the Daily Mail and Express. And this was an absolute travesty. How you dare publish that the highest correlation with me is obesity? Now, I've been eating for the last 6 months. I didn't used to be like this. I was slim, whatever, but I thought, I'm going to talk about this. I have to get myself to the right size so I'm not being patronizing. And also I had to test out the theory that the researcher who published this said. And his theory was a little bit more like that people who are a bit fatter, a bit lazier, and, you know, don't look after yourself, eat a bit of a bag of chips, and that kind of laziness fits in with wanting an easy life and voting leave rather than competing economically. I complete rubbish, okay, but isn't that. It's partly that Public Health England's estimate of obesity isn't great. They've used some things to model it and actually quite closely voted to vote Leave. But this is what I think the strongest thing is. The people who are, for their age and sex, the thinnest and fittest in this country, there's one social group. They're immigrants. Immigrants are young, healthy, thin and fit. They do not die, we know this, they work three jobs and they have a PhD in an MSc. And they're in your hotel bedroom for you. So London has a very high proportion of immigrants, and they're thinner. Areas where people don't come are fatter because the immigrants aren't there. And it isn't just the immigration. There's a contagion effect. If you live in an area where other people are thin, you eat less. In the United States, I am spent. Really am. I am, I'm kind of quite toned in the United States.
British
are
not that far behind.
No, we're not that far. We're hungry. We are the most obese country of Europe. I once spent a week in Kyoto. I was the fattest man in Kyoto for a whole week. So anyway, there's your strongest correlation. It's not causation, but it means, I think, deprivation. Here's deprivation. Deprivation measure along the bottom. Percentage of special leave on the side, most authorities, the age of the population. The correlation is 0.03. That means basically none. But you can kind of see something in there if you want to see something in there. This is the problem with statistics. You know, 0.03 is not in and out of your head, it's gone already. And you're looking and going, I can see a pattern there. The correlation for obesity is 0.8, and that's 0.03. It is fascinating. The areas around the edge are outliers. They're not normal. Poor London boroughs are not normal. Parts of the Fens are not normal. St Albans is not normal. The normal is in the middle, where there's no space to put a name. The normal name is. And Dominic Cummings is not a first libel. So I'll just let you look at this picture and let you Google Dominic. And Dominic was, what's his name? Campaign director. These people matter. There were people who really wanted this. I don't think Boris did, actually. I think Boris really wants to be Prime Minister. Really, really wants to be Prime Minister. But just as I showed you the rising voters of the far right from 97 onwards, the people who really want this, really matters to them. The sovereign, the independent, true British great nation with the race that has beaten all other races with a natural affinity to rule the world and bring civilization to other nations needs to be unshackled so that we can have Empire 2.0 and be the Singapore of the West. And if you just believe me and you're not traitorous and you go with the program, we will have so many trade deals you won't believe how lucky you are. They believe it. Actually believe it. Because they've been brought up to believe that some people are better than other people. Dominic Cummings has written the whole thesis about this, this eugenics. And not just some people like him are far better in terms of other people, but some races are better than others. It wasn't our fault that Darwin published The Origin of Species in this country at the point when we were the most powerful group of people on the planet. But that's had a legacy effect on the way that some of us think. Things have changed. The proportion of people who say they're embarrassed, I'm not embarrassed, I'm English, I can't help it, that's it. Right? But there's a little light. I'm not proud. I really am not proud. I do know some of the things we did in Kenya, in America, and in China, and in Ireland, and at home. You know, I'm not proud, but I'm not embarrassed. Who else is going to be affected? This was published, I think, a week or so before the poll. Standard & Poor, spot on. Some of these financial analysts are really good. The country that's going to be most affected, apart from by Brexit, is Ireland. Right, they really did get that down well. But, you know, we now know what the Good Friday Agreement is. You know, we didn't know. Then Malta, then Luxembourg, then Cyprus. They're small. They're not going to be affected very much. And the EU's going to look after Ireland anyway. It claims are up in Dublin, because it will be the only English-speaking country in Europe, in the EU part of the EU. So it's probably going to be okay. If that graph had France and Germany being badly affected by this, it wouldn't matter, but it doesn't. And we don't yet know that. Graph, I think, from the TEC. Babies are more likely to live in Greece than in this country the first year of life. Well, by the way, babies who die in this country, their mums are English born. Because the immigrants are young and fit and healthy, and their babies don't die. We're better off in Greece, people live longer in Greece. And that's the drop in average wages in this country. Here's the Financial Times, slightly more complicated graph. But you know, the FT are saying it now. We're on our own quadrant in this graph because we are the only country who, when GDP went up and we finally recovered, decided, oh, we won't share that with everybody else. We'll keep the extra money for the people who own the companies. But if you're trying to piss off a population, you couldn't have gone around it a better way. David Cameron introduced a happiness index in 2010. Can you remember it? Introducing the happiness index. Who can remember it? Just an idea. A few of you. Now, who can remember them announcing what the happiness index said in 2011, 12, 13, 14? No, they never did. But eventually, it was very complicated, had 30 components, but four of them were about health. But those four about health got worse every year. People were saying, it's like Spike Milligan. People were saying, I'm ill, I'm getting iller. And I showed this to my friends in epidemiology, and they said, it's never. Nothing that bad ever happens, it's just a mistake in the way we collected the data. And then people started dying. First of all, we get the change for babies. This is a graph published by ONS last year, not much attention. When I was born, 1968, we had about the best infant mortality rate in the world. We had the first baby babies in the John Bradley. It's great. By 1990, we were the seventh best in Europe. Not bad for neonatal mortality. Dying in the first 4 weeks of life, basically dying around the time of birth. Dying at the point when you need a midwife and a doctor. By 2015, we dropped to 19th. When I was born, you were three times more likely to die if you were born in Portugal. Portugal was a place that we didn't know what to do about. Now you're better off in Portugal. This carries on, and by 2025, you'll be better off born in Romania than the UK. Your chances of getting through the first 4 weeks of life. And what do the BBC do when they do more and less a statistics program? They go, oh, it's not a real statistic because lots of them are premature babies. There are premature babies born all across Europe, and more of them survive. Since that graph was drawn, infant mortality rates have actually gone up 2 years in a row for the first time ever. Things are falling apart. This is the all-age sex standardized mortality rate. Right, this isn't true to aging, because you've included that. When this first began to go wrong in 2013, public health England said it was flu for the cold winter. It wasn't a cold winter. That's easy to measure. Got a thermometer. 2013 was not a cold winter. The last cold winter was 2010. They're still saying cold winters. They're not cold. And flu. Flu is a little bit harder to dismiss. But essentially, that doesn't happen by flu. The last time that flu resulted in a falling life expectancy for the entire country was 1918-19. Thankfully, Public Health England for 4 months have not mentioned the word flu. I keep saying that, and I say 5 months, 6, do not do it. I will say it again. This is not flu. This kind of virus. And the worst virus anywhere in Europe. Other things going wrong as we come into testing to get to the end. And I need to think of a big laugh in this talk to do it. This is a portion of children and families in England who are renting privately. Quarter, up to a quarter. It's never supposed to happen. If you're renting privately, the landlord can move you on with 2 months' notice. That means you might have to go to a new school, lose all your friends. On average in London, families who are private renting, which is now more than the social housing, are moved on every 3 years. Imagine having to change school and get a new set of friends every 3 years in London. London did have the best GCSE results in the country a few years ago. We thought, how can we destroy this? I know. Let's make all the children of London, at least a large group of them, itinerant and have to move between schools all the time and not know whether they're safe where they are actually living. Other things that are very odd. I showed you the spiral graph of the far right before. This spiral graph here is what happened in April, May and June last year, and it's never ever happened before. In every poll we have ever measured in Britain, the opinion of people in Britain has never changed that quickly. No. Unbelievable. Whoever advised Theresa May to call that election was completely right. There's absolutely no way she could lose it. All the data said there's no way you can lose it, just call it. You know, Germany's down here. I can tell you a story, but basically it's cascading down to oblivion. You know, take him out now. Just do the mercy killing. You know, it's worth it. Get back to normal Labour. And then this happened. And was it because the sun suddenly played Beau Jezzer? You know, was it the tabloids? Anyway, it's never happened before for any political party in Britain since we started measuring polls in the 1950s. That's on a pub in a poor part of Islington. Here's the swing of general elections. 1945 used to be the largest swing, landslide. 1997, quite high, 8.8, but that really was people voting against, what was it, 18 years of conservative rule by then, and the cufflinks. Blair then manages to get 2 negative swings. The reputation of being good at elections is wrong. Swing went against him, swing goes against him. Brown, with the other financial crisis, with an even bigger negative swing than Blair. And then, bless him, Ed Miliband. Got a 1.4% positive swing. That was brilliant. That was absolutely incredible. In the context of what had happened before, 1.4 was stunning. Then we gave Ed credit. And then look what happened next. We don't know what's going to happen next. We don't know what will happen if there's a general election. We cannot tell from past presidents what is possible because we've broken all the rules in the last years. We do know that we are an extremely strange country. This is the proportion of GDP spent on public services. There's my favourite little country at the top. It's not a wasteland. Things are going okay in Finland. They haven't won the Eurovision Song Contest of some time, but otherwise they're okay. And you might say, oh, well, that's a strange little Scandinavian country. Well, the next one down is France. Okay? Where people live longer, where houses cost less, and they're better. We're down here, and I can't quite reach, but essentially the Labour Manifesto takes you to about 37.6, up from 36. The entire open window of British politics is that wide. That's what we're currently flagging. And it's understandable. You know, there's no way we could become Finland. I'll say no way, and I said you can't predict. But it'll take 30, 40 years for France. But we're currently having an argument saying that going from there to slightly below Japan is absolutely impossible. You can't possibly run a country like that. You have to have tuition fees. Whereas all these countries don't. It's geographical. It's geographical knowledge that we don't have. We do not know how the rest of Europe operates. That's the graph of migration. If you want the world map, this is a world map. People move around. It's what we do. You can't stop them by immigration controls. All the immigration controls do is change the nature of who gets in. But the number of people who come to this country is pretty predictable. It depends how many babies you had about 25 years before. If you have fewer babies, you get more immigrants, aged around 25. If you have more babies, you get fewer immigrants 25 years later because there are less opportunities. And every immigration control we have done has had no effect on that relationship. Immigration is what makes areas. The reason that the rich parts of Kensington are coloured yellow here is the money that came in from the empire, but the migration of people who came in with them. And the reason that the areas are poor is people coming in from the countryside, often with their pigs, to the area called the Piggeries, which was Notting Dale in the west of London. And all of our areas have been made by immigration. This is an area which is made by immigration. But when things fall apart and they go badly wrong, and your hospitals and your schools and housing isn't working, politicians have a vested interest, if they like, inequality, to tell you that the reason it's all getting worse is the immigrants. Not the real reason why it's all been getting worse. But we're about to find out. Everything's changing. And you can watch the changes happen week by week. My last slide. The reaction to that, the timing of that, and the reaction to that, and the inquiry that will start with that. And sadly, it will be something else next year, and something else the year after. But had that happened 10 or 20 years before, it wouldn't be the same type of story. It would just have been a fire. The reason that that tells a particular story is the times we're going through. My mum can remember the equivalent of that early on. It was a different time, after we were becoming more and more equal. And the disaster my mum can remember is when a cold slag heap collapsed onto a school in a village in Wales. And the National Coal Board at first offered £5 to every parent as compensation for their child. Now the reason why Aberfan was such an iconic disaster was that we were coming into the 1960s and we were sick of the kind of country that we'd been. And we wanted to become a place that actually didn't put the price of £5 on the heads of children. And it changed. And the reason why this is so iconic is because there's a sense that things are deeply bad and wrong and people want them to change. The problem is that they were only given one choice of how to change this. And that was to vote Leave. And so 52% voted Leave. And here we are. Thank you very much. Please ask me some more questions.
I mean, it seems as if you're explaining the whole Brexit problem as if it's sort of British exceptionalism.
Yeah.
And I mean, looking across Europe at the minute, I'm not sure that that there's something else going on. But particularly with reference to the Spain law, with reference to the British Empire, there were globalisation processes. Do you consider anything at all about EU policy or practice that has any role to play in the emergence of that vote?
So there's an argument, particularly on the left.
Well, I'm thinking of Jeremy. I mean, it's so strange that we're describing the reference to empire. Jeremy Corbyn has been a vociferous anti-EU campaigner until last week, as far as I've seen.
Yeah.
I mean, he could not confuse his unitary government. Empire,
no, but he's not typical of the bulk of voting for Labour.
There's a long tradition in the left-wing politics of anti-EUism. It was portrayed at a long time as being, you know, the capitalist conspiracy.
I agree, but no other country has tried to leave apart from Greenland. There is something odd about it.
Well, Greece couldn't leave, could it? I mean, Greece
couldn't get any money from it,
couldn't
we? We're as bankrupt as Greece. Well, it's not quite so obvious yet. No, it's obvious to us, but we are on the numbers. Greece could have left, you could leave. Greece had left, and people were arguing to leave, and they'd gone straight to the track line. You'd have had a flood of tourists into Greece. I wouldn't say it was a good thing, but it was definitely an option for Greece to leave. Now Greece doesn't have to leave, because what's happening now is that Germany is treating Greece much more nicely, because now there is a model of solidarity. But the other big thing that's happening now is that the cheerleaders of a market-driven, nasty, brutal, capitalist version of the EU, which was us, are going. So the really interesting question is, what's the EU going to do?
Well, what's Macron doing in France?
Well, nothing.
What vision does he have for
he'll be moving that little line at the top, 1%, in one direction. That's more hospital beds per person, more doctors per person, better school results, hardly any private schools, all good local schools.
But their health system is completely different funding mechanism.
Yes,
we're comparing
but
two very different
health systems. We're comparing two countries that are side by side to each other.
Several European countries have had very high rates. I mean, okay, Britain might be the biggest, but we have, you know, you could make a case of Belgium being as violent, if not more violent, than what they did in Africa, for example. You know, where does that your idea of empire fit into those countries, and why they're not being hit, or why they're not agitating?
Because they never made as much out of their empires as they did in the last few years. I mean, Belgium cutting the hands off children in the Congo got it some chocolate, but it didn't make it as rich. You know, all the other empires are tiny compared to ours. Empire's part of it. I mean, there are hundreds of things that are involved in this. But if you're trying to explain why we don't understand who we are, why we think immigrants cause our problems. Why do we talk about immigrants like this? You know, the kind of arrogance that we have. Our geography textbooks basically told us that we were superior in the 1930s and 40s. I can show you awful quotes. And there's that inkling of it even in the current curriculum. One at the back.
What could we do to make Britain a better place now, regardless of how Brexit goes?
Well, I think we could. I mean, the nearest equivalent I can find is Suez. And I think people are saying that this is Suez times 10, but no reason for 10. And I'd love somebody to come up with another for me. Suez felt dramatic, depressing, shocking at the time. A few years later, people were asking whether this is a book you would like your wife and servants to read, and they were laughed at. And we had a swing in the 60s, and it became a much nicer country. So it's entirely possible for the Brexit process, whatever happens. Theresa can send a letter at 10 o'clock on the 29th of March and cancel it. It's going to be a really interesting day that day. Whatever happens, the shock is going to have been so big that an older generation can't say, trust us, we got it right. My granddad was born in 1916, and he can remember coming back from the Second World War, and the feeling coming back from the Second World War is an older generation hadn't just sent them to fight one unnecessarily stupid war. They'd actually arranged things such that there had to be a Second World War. And the people who came back from that Second World War had almost no respect for their elders who had done this and created something new. I think that the opportunities, I'm a glass half full person, I think the opportunities of this are huge. I think the best writing on Brexit has been done by black journalists in the press. We're revered. But if you look at who's telling the stories, these are stories that I've come to believe. They're written by people like Gary Young. They're not written by white journalists. What did they know that we didn't get? But that's my, you know, I remember telling you at the beginning this story about a teenager around the fire. I worry I'm telling you a lot about what I believe about the world, partly with some numbers. Still have a couple,
I'm going to have to mind for them. And one thing that's surprising me of the UK, currently, I believe the 17 was different, is the lack of protest. Fees go up £9,000. There's one demonstration. Prince Charles gets a bit shaken. Sorted. Nothing happened. A result with this 52-48. As you said, if it had been the other way around, it would have gone on for ages. You're like, okay, it's a big decision, and the people who voted Remain are not really fighting for it. I get that feeling. It's okay, the referendum had this result, that's it. And I think that's also one of the big differences, for example, with France, or Greece, or Italy, or Spain. The moment some people don't like something, they will protest. And I've seen the USS pension run recently. I was at the picket line. I think 80% of staff standing there were from outside the UK. British people didn't care.
Yeah. All those sort of Fischler protests is the thing which might be later turned by. So my friend Demetrius, who I've written books about, when he was 15 years old in Athens, slept in his school for 3 months because all his children slept in their school for 3 months because they were on a strike. And then they were in that Stigmata Square confronting the police. And he remembers the police moving back in fear. And he was thinking suddenly as a 15-year-old, we've got them. And they're looking behind us, realizing that the Builders Union were there with very large sticks. That's his tradition. We don't have this. Even in 1968, LSE, it was a handful of students protesting in 1968. But we may not have it. We haven't had a revolution. We didn't need one, we had an empire. You know, why do you need a revolution when you're actually doing so very well? And so there isn't a tradition of protest.
So coming back to geography, one of the things I find fascinating is that a lot of what you've done, I think, is English. And if you look at the folk, particularly in Scotland, less so in Northern Ireland, it's totally different. So do you think the United Kingdom will survive Brexit, or do you think Scotland will become independent?
There's a man called Freddie Heineken, who owned the Heineken Brewery, and in 92, Freddie Heineken commissioned a new map of Europe, splitting up in large countries, because he thought they should all be about 10 million. And he got Yugoslavia surprisingly right. And the reason I'm saying this is that Freddie Heineken's map of the UK is where we're currently heading towards. You know, if you're trying to join the Scots, if you're trying to create the circumstances for independent Scotland, this is the way to do it. But also the reasons for the original marriage of convenience have gone, which was you're better off together because there's a world to conquer. That's gone. We're looking nearer to the potential United Ireland than we ever thought we were going to see. In a way, United Ireland has already happened. You put a yoghurt pot on that border and you're in trouble. That's what we've discovered. So that's fascinating. Wales is the interesting question, the place that just hasn't shouted. Is there a border anymore with Wales? But we're looking at the breaking up of the United Kingdom. But it was a kingdom created for convenience. I mean, they had to find a word, so they came up with the word Britain. Hardly used before. The song called Britannia was commissioned very shortly after the Act of Union by a man who spoke German. He was the Prince of Wales. We created and fabricated an identity. The Victorians tried to paint Northern Britain, but the Scots wouldn't have it. And that identity is falling apart now. And that's one interesting thing. You know, if Scotland does leave, it immediately becomes the most unequal, failing Scandinavian state. Nevertheless, if I was Scottish, I would go for independence.
Conscious of the time, I wonder.
Just two more quickly, just okay.
Shelf for that. So, you said about the inequality with the young voters, now people not showing up, give them back to the site. Do you think that was mostly because of the taxation in the 90s, or do you think it might have been a bit of patronization, like in the media as well?
Or patronization. The 90s created a tradition of you know, let's say, vote. Vote is partly religious. You have to believe your vote matters, because you know, even in this one, you know, one vote isn't actually going to change the result.
So voting is partly a religious act of faith that you do because you believe in something greater. Well, I like to believe it. But the great danger that we did for the young is getting them out of the religion. Voting is okay as long as everybody else does it, it works. I think that's the problem. So we're now in this incredible position. People tend to vote the same way they voted last time. They used to vote like their farm voted, but things got better. But you mainly vote the same way you voted in the last election. And all these young people in June 2017 who voted Labour, what do you think they're going to be doing next time? And there'll be many more. Should we do one last one from the very back? Is there somebody sort of yawning? you've had you before, unless anybody else go on.
Your wealth of, all stated that the wealth I've seen is the explanation around home counties and ethics, and that's a surprise this evening. Why is that not made into the analysis of John Harrison and Kurt Aitken, his Allegheny, where there's case study after case study of post-industrial northern cities, on the effect of the call, the allies to walk through the jobs that are around Warsaw, etc., etc., and the documents. Yeah. Is that a line, a press line centre like the Oregon or something else that misses?
Well, it's a construction
analysis.
It's John. John lives in Fulham. John comes from Manchester and he likes going to North. And he doesn't like working in London. But John just hasn't gone. John Harris has written about the North. He just hasn't gone to the home counties. It's not liberal. I'll send him an email to do what you just say. You should do it, but it's not. But if you do go to these parts, you know, parts of Britain are falling apart and they look like Eastern Europe when you go, compared to when you see parts of Germany, parts of France, parts of Switzerland. So it's not hard to construct that story. The story that's really interesting to construct, I did it on Newsnight at Tewkesbury, you know, these supposed picture postcard places, when you actually go to them, and you find that there's a Poundland and a betting shop and a tattoo parlour on the high street of some posh sounding, you know, town. And you find that the grandparents are voting leave because the house prices are so high that their children can never afford a house in an average part of England. And because they're told, even though when I was in Tewkesbury for a day, I counted four people who were not white, but because they've been told it's the immigrants that have stopped the houses being affordable. It's a little, and it's a tragic way to discover that immigration isn't our problem, and that one in three midwives in London are EU and not UK citizens. But we're about to find out.
First, the irony is that now they're saying house prices would fall by 30%, so they don't come around that way.
And house prices in London have been falling since August 2016. I'll leave you with this and we'll stop. Tokyo at 89 house prices half in 1 year for whole Tokyo, but the best is Amsterdam. And Amsterdam, from the peak of house prices in real terms at the height of the power of Amsterdam, they fell for 250 years in real terms. So if you're sitting in Stoke and looking at those smug people in London, just think, 250 years, potential house price fall. And how do you get the house prices down in the centre of London where the oligarchs are buying their safe houses? You make it possible that the country may elect somebody who will take away or tax the wealth of people with large houses in London. How many Russians are going to keep mansions in London if they think that Jeremy Corbyn will become Prime Minister? And I just think that's one just worth... That's the evening. Thank you. Thank you.